This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Commodore Jan Drent, recorded on March 21st, 2014 at the University of Victoria in Victoria, BC, by Sarah Taylor. Commodore Drent, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Thank you. And just ask you to state your name and rank for the recorder,
sure.
Please.
My name is Jan Drent, and I retired as a Commodore.
Thank you very much. So I'd just like to begin with some basic biographical questions.
Sure.
Where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles, California.
Okay. Did you grow up in Los Angeles?
I was born in 1935, November 35. Yes, I did. I grew up in California, in Los Angeles and Oakland. And then when I was had finished high school, our family moved up to Vancouver. Then I went to UBC and became involved with the Canadian Navy.
Okay. And what was it like growing up in Los Angeles and Oakland?
Well, it was very, it's obviously a beautiful part of the world to grow up in, and the USA, had an enormous amount to offer. I think culturally, things have changed down there. You know, we now hear a lot about the gun culture, and I must say, when I, even up to high school years, we certainly were not aware of this fixation on having the right to bear arms and all that sort of thing.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
The reason I grew up in California was my father was a Dutch sea captain. That means he was captain of a freighter, which carried passengers as well, which was on a run around the world. And he married a woman from Germany. And so in order to have as much time with his family as he could, he settled her in California, because I said around the world, but the ship never went to Europe. It really started in what was then the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, and went around the world picking up cargo and discharging cargoes. And however, as part of this round the world voyage, they spent several weeks on the west coast of North America. In those days, of course, freighters would spend several days in each harbor, because loading and unloading cargo was quite a labor-intensive, slow process. So he would spend several weeks on the west coast of North America, and that would include visits to Los Angeles and nearby ports. The company also allowed him to have his wife on board for shorter voyages. So for all those reasons, he settled. When he got married, he brought her out to California. I was born, my brother was born. I think their original intention probably was to end up back in Europe. The war came along, we went to school, and things just developed that we stayed in North America.
Okay. You mentioned your father was a sea captain.
Yes.
Did any of your family serve in the military?
No. No. Yeah, I have some German cousins who were involved. In the wartime, yeah, sure. And a German uncle was a career naval officer, but not in the direct family. Yeah.
Okay. Did his career as a sea captain have any influence on your decision to
enlist? Yes, I'm sure it did, because he took us on one short voyage from Oakland up to Portland, and of course we were always very interested when we were in. When a ship was in port, we'd go on board, and the whole sea culture was of interest to my brother and to me.
Okay.
And so when I was at university age, there really were very limited opportunities to be in deep sea shipping in Canada, because by that time we didn't have a deep sea merchant fleet. Left, and so the options were, the big attractive option was the Navy.
And what did you study at UBC?
Well, yes, I did an arts degree. I did physics and German.
Okay. And when did you enlist in the Navy?
When I went to UBC in 54, I joined the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve as an officer cadet. And there was a program then called the University Naval Training Division, which provided training for university students. We trained once a week in Vancouver, and then during the summers we went to one of the coasts for summer training. And really the minimum program was to do 2 summers, and that gave the successful candidates enough in the way of professional training to qualify them for a commission in the reserves. A lot of us did 3 summers, and when I finished UBC, I switched over to join the regular force.
Okay, and what motivated you to enlist?
Well, because it was a seagoing, it offered a seagoing career.
Did you ever consider Army or Air Force?
No. In fact, in California, we had a sort of a cadet corps in our high school, so I'd done some Army cadet training. No, the Army and Air Force did not interest me.
Okay. I know you mentioned the 3 summers at UBC.
Yeah.
What other kind of training did you go through after you enlisted?
Yeah, and I should say the third summer, by the third summer, I was really had done my minimum qualifications, so I was doing, well, you call it a practicum, I guess. I was serving in ships, getting time on the bridge, and of course, this is sort of the classic pattern of naval training. It's an apprenticeship where you get some basic training, and then you go and you learn on the job. And so I started learning on the job in my third summer. And then after my third summer, when I graduated from UBC, I was sent to Halifax to start some more professional courses. I joined some young men who had been at HMC's Venture, that was a naval officer training center in Esquimalt, and they were also at the stage then in their career where they were ready for these professional courses, and we did those for an academic year. We started in September, finished in June, and then we were all sent to ships on either coast to consolidate our training.
Okay, so where was your first posting?
Well, the first posting was in a destroyer in Halifax, but I had spent my first summer training was also in Halifax, and I first went to sea with the Navy out of Halifax.
Which destroyer in Halifax was
My first summer was in HMCS Iroquois, which was a ship built during the war, and she had just come back from Korea along with Huron and Iroquois-Huron, and the cruiser Quebec did a training cruise for UNTD cadets, and we did that in June 55.
Okay. And what other postings have you held?
Yes. Well, the normal pattern is that, you know, for upper deck officer like me, was that you do your basic professional training courses, then you go off to sea and you become qualified to have charge of the ship by yourself, to be a bridge watch keeper. And then along the way, you do some more professional training, so you have other functions, you know, air control or navigation, whatever. And then I did a 1-year course after being at sea for five years, so I could be in charge of the operations room. So that was a professional course in Halifax. And then later on, I did a staff training in Toronto, which, again, is pretty standard, that the officers who have been in for about 10 years are then prepared to take on more senior positions and to move into staff responsibilities. And that training consists of a mix of giving them practice and researching, giving presentations, studying military strategy, tactics, geopolitical affairs, and so on. That was okay. You're asking for other postings, so we're talking about it. The first several years of my career were very much focused on ships and shipboard jobs. Then, after my staff course, I was sent off to do language training to get ready to go to Moscow. When I came back from Moscow the first time, I was sent in command of a destroyer, helicopter carrying destroyer on the East Coast. That was followed by 2 years on exchange with the Royal Navy in England. I was on the staff of their staff college. And then I went back to Moscow second time. After that, came here to command a second ship on the West Coast. This ship had a training role. And then after that, I was promoted to the rank of captain and came ashore to do a staff job here in Esquimalt. Went back from there to command the West Coast supply ship. And then after that, I was sent to Ottawa to do a staff job. So the last 6 years of my career really were spent ashore in two staff jobs, one in Ottawa and one overseas in Brussels at the NATO headquarters.
Okay. When you mentioned that you got command of a helicopter carrying destroyer when you came back from Moscow, mm-hmm. Which one was that?
Well, it was HMCS Annapolis, and she is no longer with us, but
Okay. So when were you first approached about becoming a naval attaché?
Yes, well, the Navy had, well, the Canadian Forces have a bureaucracy that looks after personnel, moving them around to fill positions and to make sure that they get the right training to fit the requirements, etc. So the career manager, that's what he's called, and these are all he's, I realize, because at that time there weren't that many females in uniform. The career manager for naval officers came to Toronto while I was on the staff course, and he spoke to all the naval lieutenant commanders, and he had a plan as to, where he would propose to post us. And that's when I was first asked. And because going to Moscow involved the family, I had an opportunity to accept or decline.
Okay. So how did you feel when you first received the offer about Moscow?
Well, quite surprised, because I'd never ever thought of this as a possible posting. I'd always been kind of focused on the seagoing track, and so surprised, and then kind of intrigued at the thought about it.
What intrigued you by it?
Well, the fact that this was we were then in the Cold War, and I think we had all read a certain amount about the Soviet Union, and we used to run across Russian fishing trawlers off our coasts, and we were all aware of the growth of the Russian Navy, and aware of Russia's geopolitical importance.
Okay. Did you think the position would have any effect on your future career?
Well, frankly, I did not really think that through. I mean, I was a pretty loyal naval officer, and I thought, well, if the Navy wants me to send me to Moscow and thinks I can do it, I'll do it.
How did your family feel about the appointment?
Well, obviously, it was a much bigger leap for my wife, and she was a bit reluctant, but like a loyal Navy wife, she went along. As at the time, we had just had our first child. So when we went over, this little girl was 3 years old, and so that was a sort of an extra dimension to the to the expedition, because well, there were all the issues of if the job involved travel within the Soviet Union, and it was we never traveled alone. So if I wanted my wife to, if my wife wanted to travel with me, or I wanted her to travel with me, we had to figure out a way of looking after this child. Otherwise, when we were in Moscow, there was a fair amount of official entertaining to do, or to be received. So we had the issue of babysitters. There were all these aspects to be worked out. Yeah.
So you mentioned your wife. Can you tell me a little bit about how you met her?
Well, I met her in Halifax, at the time, all single people in the Navy lived on, who were posted ship, lived on board. So we had young sailors who lived on board, and young officers, and there were always, gee, 6 to 8 probably young officers in all of the ships on the East Coast, and who were bachelors living on board. And our social life really revolved largely around our associates around the Navy. So we, the mess, the eating area we used is called the wardroom, and that was also our social area. So we'd generally have a party Friday nights, and the married officers would bring their wives down, and the bachelor officers would hunt around and invite somebody to come along. And so it was really in the course of organizing myself for one of these wardroom parties that a fellow officer said, "Oh, but yeah, well, you know, my wife works with somebody who would that we think would be a good match." So there you go.
So what did your wife do for a career?
Well, she was, at that time, she was getting her master's in social work at the Maritime School of Social Work, which was affiliated with Dalhousie University.
Okay, and so how long had you been married when you were appointed to Moscow?
To Moscow, yeah. 8 years, yeah.
Okay, and what year were you appointed?
1970.
And what was your rank when you took up the posting?
Commander.
Okay, so what kind of training did you undergo prior to taking up the position?
Yes, well, the main, the most significant training was language training. And we did this at the, and I say we because both of us did it, and we were encouraged, I was encouraged that the wife should get this training as well. And we did this at something called the Canadian Forces Language School, which was in Ottawa, part of Ottawa called Vanier. And the Canadian Forces Language School at that time really functioned as a language school for the public for people in the public service who were going to be posted abroad. So we had colleagues, fellow students were from then External Affairs, RCMP, I'm not sure what other departments. And we had enlisted people doing training and officer ranks with their spouses. And this school was a small institution. The instructors were all native speakers who were recruited for that reason. They, in some cases, their skills as teachers was limited, but the big advantage was that you absorbed a lot of the cultural values and attitudes from these individuals. My wife and I were very lucky that we spent half that academic year with one teacher, and then we joined an external affairs couple, so there were 4 of us to one teacher. So we had a fabulous teacher student ratio, but more importantly, the teacher we were given initially was sort of a born teacher. He was just fantastic. I know that right from the very first lesson. He functioned largely in Russian. That was his technique, and he encouraged us and brought us along. So I think we were very fortunate in getting that quality of instruction. But it was quite a demanding course because it was audio. There were tapes. I guess at that time that was fairly modern. We had homework every night. We had written assignments. We had to listen to tapes, and we had to memorize little sentences and so on. And this was pretty ambitious especially for my wife, because we then this dear little daughter had been waiting for us all day with a babysitter, and we would look after her. And yeah.
So did you do any other training in addition to the language training?
Yes, during that year, I did some contact training at National Defense Headquarters with the intelligence section to become familiar with the Soviet equipment and armed forces. And we did a brief course on handling cameras, because part of our job in Russia was to travel as much as we could and to record our impressions on camera where possible, which was not often possible, but we got some practical training in doing that in Ottawa. Yeah.
Did your wife have to do any additional training?
No, she didn't. No, that's right.
And I know you mentioned earlier that sometimes she would travel with you if you went to go somewhere. Was anything expected of her during your posting? Like a specific job?
There was the sort of unstated expectation that she would help entertain, because entertainment was part of the job. I mean, there were really three parts of the job. You were on the ambassador's staff as his advisor on naval and military matters. You were representing Canada. There was a large military diplomatic community in Moscow, so you were representing Canada in that community. And in that role, your wife was quite important, because I can't think of any attachés of any other countries that did not have a partner. So it was just sort of expected that you'd function on that level. And then there was the business of trying to travel in the country and observe, send reports back to Ottawa. And the wife was, the expectation was that the wife would be part of the team effort.
Okay. And did you have any previous experience with the USSR before your posting?
No, but as I said, we were all familiar with, we'd seen Russian ships and.
Okay. What was your role at the Canadian Embassy in Moscow?
Well, as just mentioned, I was one of three military advisors to the ambassador. We had three attachés. When I started, there was an army colonel who was the Canadian Forces Defense Attaché, and then he had two officers of a rank, one below him, Lieutenant Colonel equivalent, one Air Force officer, and me. And so our job in the embassy was, as I say, to try to monitor developments as best we could, and to keep the ambassador posted on any significant trends that we were aware of. And this was, the embassy subscribed to the Russian newspapers, and we tried to sort of scan the military newspapers, see if there's anything significant. This was quite difficult, because the Russians were extremely good at controlling news. But we also picked up things from our fellow attachés. We did a lot of trading of information. So that was the role of, and I guess specifically in that role, I remember once the ambassador asked, as you may know, there are some islands north of Japan which were seized by the Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War. And this was an ongoing aggravation for the Japanese, the Kuril Islands, because they considered these were Japanese, and they had been, it had been... wrong that they had lost these. Well, the ambassador asked me to do a little paper for him on that. He wanted to get a clearer picture. So I, of course, those were in the pre-Google days. And the embassy really had nothing in the way of a reference library. So I went to my Japanese colleague, who was a naval captain, whose English was limited, but he was very good in helping me to find English language material. And there were about 18 naval attachés in Ottawa, in Moscow, and we had monthly lunches together, and we also got together in the Japanese, was it the Japanese? Yeah. No, I guess it was the Swedish embassy had a sauna. So we would get to, we'd have a sauna together. And, that was a very enjoyable way of getting to know these other fellows and to build sort of a relationship in which we could, you know, it was quite comfortable to trade information and to work together.
Okay. You mentioned earlier kind of a team effort with your spouse to gather information. Yeah. Did you ever go on trips with attachés from other countries to do that?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I did. And we quite frequently traveled with British or American attachés because, as you know, the intelligence communities are very close. I also traveled with a Norwegian attaché. The Swedish attaché generally did not travel with other NATO attachés. They were very, and in fact, the attachés who did a lot of travel were from the Canada, UK, and US. The French did a limited amount, and the Swedes very limited. Norwegian did a certain amount. As I said, I traveled up to what was then Latvia was still Latvia, but it was under Soviet domination at the time. I did a trip there with a Norwegian.
And what were the names of the islands just above Japan?
The Kurile, K-U-R-I-L-E, Kurile Islands. Yeah, and they're still, they're still under Russia, but and they're still. Well, we hear a lot more about other islands where sovereignty is under contention because their China claims sovereignty and Japan disputes this.
Okay. So, how did your duties as a naval attaché compare with the other Canadian attachés in Moscow?
Yes. Well, pretty similar. We all had the ambition to travel as much as we could to areas that were of interest to our area. So I was really focused on trying to get to seaports and just to see what was going on. The air attaché would try to travel to areas where there were big airfields or training areas. And similarly, the army attaché would concentrate on areas where he might pick up some information about what was happening in the Soviet army.
And were you able to travel freely to visit the different ports you were interested in?
No, not at all. At the time, it's estimated that over 80% of the Soviet Union was closed to foreigners. I should have brought a map along. The U.S. Embassy had produced a nifty little map that showed the parts of the Soviet Union that were open to foreigners. And interestingly, even Moscow, there was a 25-mile area around Moscow that was open to foreigners, but in fact there were chunks of that 25-mile circle that were closed. So theoretically we could travel anywhere within that 25 miles without notifying the Soviets. And I should mention, to be fair, that there were similar restrictions on the Soviet attachés in Ottawa, although we always felt that our side played it, gave them a much longer leash, because I think they could get all the way to Kingston without notifying National Defense Headquarters. So if we wanted to go beyond the 25 miles, we had to inform the Soviet liaison officers, and it was called, you know, registering a trip. And so we would, the process was, if we wanted to, for instance, I often traveled to Leningrad, and of course now St. Petersburg, and so you would book travel and then inform the Soviet liaison officer team. You had to give them at least, more than 48 hours notice, because down to 48 hours before you were to go, they could refuse the trip, and they would just say your trip is not registered. There was never any reason given. So generally, at least a week ahead of time, you book the travel, make sure that it was available. And of course, that's another thing that the Soviets would do, would be to say, well, there's no flights that day, or there's no hotels, or whatever. Yeah, but more usually they would just say your trip's not registered. And then so once you, so that's how I got to the seaport. So as I just mentioned, Leningrad, did that quite often. Went to Archangel up on the White Sea. I tried to get to Murmansk a couple of times, but was never allowed to. The American and British colleagues were able to go there. Some attachés went out to near Vladivostok, but that was a costly trip, because to get there, that was really Nakhodka, which was this commercial harbor near Vladivostok. In order to make that trip, you'd have to then take a ship over to Japan. So it was a big time and money expense. So I also went to, we mentioned Leningrad, the Baltic. We could get to Riga, Tallinn, and another port in Latvia called Ventspils on the west coast of Latvia. We could go down to the Black Sea. So we visited Odessa and the Crimea, of course, very much in the news now, mm-hmm. and down on the southeast corner of the Black Sea, which is now where George is now located. And in fact, I did visit Sochi at the time. Yeah.
Okay. So on the trips that you were able to go on, mm-hmm. was there any kind of surveillance involved?
Yes, there was always surveillance. We generally felt that in Moscow there was not direct surveillance unless we were, unless somebody was trying to be stupid about going to places they shouldn't go or whatever. So, although, for instance, my wife, early on, there was a little parking. There was a little park near our residence. Now we all lived in apartments that were provided by the Soviets, and we lived in apartment blocks that were occupied solely by foreigners, and we were all mixed up. There were, we had Afghan neighbors, and what surprised me a little bit was what East European neighbors, the countries allied to the Soviet, then allied to the Soviet Union, the Hungarians, the Poles, and so on. As far as the Soviets are concerned, foreigners are foreigners. So we all lived in these compounds, and there was a park near our compound where my wife took our little daughter in the afternoons to a little rudimentary little playground, and she noticed that she was followed there for several times. But once the surveillance had satisfied themselves that she wasn't going off to meet somebody, or it was pretty innocuous, then there was no obvious surveillance. So we generally felt there was no surveillance in Moscow. Everywhere else, yes, no, there always was surveillance, and sometimes it was quite heavy-handed. Teams of people getting on trams with you and so on, or following you in a cab or something. Other times it was quite subtle. Mm-hmm.
Did they ever speak to you while they were?
The only real speaking encounters were when they tried to block us from going somewhere. Otherwise, their method was that they didn't like to admit that they were our surveillance. So you'd get off a tram and you'd see somebody at the end of the day, and they generally had these teams that would sort of change, and they would change hats and change coats to try to look you know, not quite as obvious, and you try to, you know, try to make some jocular remark, and but they certainly resisted that. They didn't want to have any contact with us at all. So, yeah.
You mentioned that you lived in an apartment block full of foreigners. Mm-hmm. How much interaction did you have with the actual civilians in Moscow?
Very limited contact with civilians. The Russians are xenophobic, and they were conditioned to be to keep their distance. I found that very occasionally I'd be on the street in uniform, maybe going to pick up our kid from kindergarten or something, and it was a strange feeling that people, you know, people just pretend you weren't there. So they sort of knew that contact with foreigners was not wise. Now, having said that, in fact, we had a Russian maid, and you know, we had very good contacts with her. There were a lot of Russian staff at the embassy, very cordial, friendly relations with them. And the Russians, on the whole, they're very warm and spontaneous people. And we found that having a little child, and the second time we were there, we had two little girls. That was a bit of an icebreaker, and the Russians would they were quite vocal. They'd see a little kid, they'd say, oh, you know, what a cute little kid, and sometimes they'd even scoop him up in their arms or something. They were, you know, they're not backward about being very affectionate towards children.
And what school in Moscow did your daughter go to?
So, and I should say now, in traveling, sometime that's the only time I really had contact with civilians, that somebody would, you know, you'd sit on a plane next to somebody and start talking to them, or he'd notice once, made a long flight to Siberia, and this guy noticed I was struggling to read a Russian novel, and, you know, and so you'd have a conversation, because these people, I guess they didn't automatically realized that I was sort of a dangerous foreigner. And you know, what's kind of school? Well, our daughter went to a Russian kindergarten, which was in the neighborhood, and the Russians had a very good system of providing child care, because the women all worked. So this was the neighborhood child care place, the kindergarten, and had a very good program, a very warm staff, and our daughter learned Russian very quickly, and thanks to us having a Russian maid, you know, that sort of reinforced her rapid learning. Yeah.
Okay. Just go back to the plane you mentioned.
Sure.
So was your interaction with civilians, kind of when you were traveling, very different from the civilians in Moscow, did you find?
Because there were these spontaneous encounters where, there were other encounters where, I remember once, I guess it was down in the Crimea, in Yalta, I had a conversation with somebody in a restaurant, and then I noticed a couple of surveillance people then went over and talked to them. So, obviously this person didn't realize who I was. Maybe that was just a foreigner. I'll talk to the foreigner, and then I guess the surveillance sort of, well, they obviously were interested in, you know, what did this foreigner say to you, and so on and so forth.
Okay. Just to go back to the Canadian embassy, you mentioned that there were Russian employees there as well. So how many employees were there working at the embassy when you were there?
Yeah, and just going back to the Russians, I mean, even, you know, we always, when we went to these other cities, we always made a point, well, it was also, we were interested in what the city offered as well. So in the evenings, we'd either, the choice in the evening really was either you'd go to a restaurant, and Slivers was always slow, so that would sort of take the evening, or if you went to the ballet or opera or something, or a concert, we'd cook up a little meal in our room. So we generally travel with a little electric element, where we could heat things and have cans of food and stuff. So where am I going with this? With the So one of the places we visited, obviously, Leningrad was bulging with museums, and one of the most obvious targets was the Hermitage. And I can remember, in the Hermitage, every room had sort of these elderly ladies who were there as sort of the providing security and, mm-hmm. and service. And I remember, you know, going over to ask one of these ladies about some of the paintings or whatever, and then immediately the civilians sort of moved in close because they wanted to know what we were seeing. I think they were always, their fear was, or their briefing was, well, these people might be contacting somebody, you know, there might be an exchange of information here, so you've got to be on top of what these people are doing. So as long as we weren't talking to Soviets, we were okay, you know. Yes, now you were asking about how many Russians at the embassy. There were probably, in total, 8 to 10, or, yeah, maybe 8. Yeah, not 10. There was a staff of translators and receptionists. We had a Canadian... security was provided by Canadians, but the contact with, you know, if somebody phoned the embassy, they'd get a Soviet citizen on the phone who would answer the phone and direct their calls. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what about Canadian civilian employees at the embassy?
Yes, probably. Well, there were two kinds. I mean, it was a class distinction. You know, they're the officers. They were all had diplomatic status. So we had a trade and commerce at that time. We had a trade and commerce section. They had three trade officers. At that time, we were very interested in selling grain to Russia, and we were also trying. They were also trying to foster business, Canadian business, doing business in the Soviet Union. So the three of them. There were four foreign service officers, plus the ambassador. And then there were the three military officers, and then there was a consular officer. So those were all the people who had diplomatic status. Now, they were supported by administrative staff. So they were Canadian secretaries, security. They were Canadian communications people. There were about half a dozen communications people who, I think they were all men at the time, and they handled... sort of sending telexes or telegrams to Ottawa and receiving them.
You mentioned kind of the trade a little bit. How did your duties compare to the other civilian employees in the embassy?
We traveled a lot more. So the trade of the other staff, the officers who traveled the most were the trade people, but they... Like the one of them was sort of looked after agriculture, and he would make an annual trip to Ukraine to check out the wheat crops. But that was really about it. They traveled very little. Their focus was being in the capital and interacting with other diplomats and with their Russian counterparts. They had a lot more contact with the Russian government because they'd have bilateral business with, you know, trying to expedite sale of at the time there was a frack master there was a firm trying to sell the Russians equipment for oil exploration, and so that's the sort of a thing that the trade officers would be involved with.
Okay. So what was a typical day like for you in Moscow?
Well, generally, the office hours were roughly 9:30 to 5:30. So go in the morning and check the newspapers, check any telegrams that had come in from Ottawa. As I said, we had the diplomatic status people all had a weekly meeting with the ambassador. There was a room in the embassy which was secure. That is, you could say things and hope that they weren't there. It wasn't bugged everywhere else in the embassy. You assumed it was bugged, and likewise in our apartment, we always operated on the assumption that what we were saying was being intercepted. So you'd have that meeting. Going back to daily routine, I might phone to set up a meeting with a colleague in another embassy. Might be going to a lunch Although more often the entertaining was done later in the day, in the late afternoons there would be cocktail parties in various embassies. They threw cocktail parties to in connection with their national day. The Russians occasionally entertained us at large receptions. One of those was the Russians had a Soviet Army Day, and I was that was generally a in a large place with the traditional the way they did this was they would have food on tables. You always stood and you'd sort of graze with the food and go around and talk to people. And I don't know why I found I was suddenly I was the last sort of Westerner there, and I was sort of leaving the room, but I was surprised to find that the East Europeans also were all, we were all the same. The Hungarians, Poles, foreigners are foreigners. The Russians stayed back. They there wasn't a sort of special bonhomie extended to the East Europeans. Yeah.
So is there anything else you would add to your responsibilities as a naval attaché that we haven't talked about?
We had three clerks who were, again, were men who had brought their wives with them. And so I had a Navy fellow who would help me prepare reports and research stuff. And so I guess felt a responsibility to make sure that he and his family were doing all right. The Canadian Embassy had a club, which was quite popular in Moscow. They had the Canadian Club, where they had Friday nights. They'd have beer and some food. And for the non-diplomatic people, members of the embassy, that was a very important social center for them, because they all did feel isolated. Most of them had not had the benefit of Russian language training, so they were struggling, in this city where people were not friendly, because they were told by the government not to be friendly. So they felt alien, and the Canadian Club was a very welcome outlet. And they had the embassy had a hockey team and would organize picnics and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier kind of a fear of having bugs in different rooms. Was that a problem with the Canada Club as well? Or
probably, but the noise level would be pretty loud, so who knows, to what extent did they try to bug the Canadian Club, right. We had crude little things. In our office we had a little machine where we'd switch it on, and it was a noise. It was a recording of a cocktail party, so there'd be a lot of voices. And so we always thought, is this going to disguise? I don't know. I imagine it was sophisticated interception. You could easily separate out other voices. Mm-hmm. But again, were we really worth targeting? I don't think so. And we had, you've seen these little kids' pads. There's a little plastic sheet, and you can write on it and erase it. Well, that's my wife and I would use those in the flat, or we'd use those around the office too. We'd say, "Well, I'm planning to go to so and so," right? Or "Did you hear?"
Yeah. So, what kind of relationship did you have with your Soviet liaison officers?
Well, I guess you could call it correct. They were all intelligence specialists. That is, that they had probably started their careers in whatever branch of the armed forces they were, and they were predominantly Army. And then they had sort of moved into defense intelligence. So several of them had, in fact, served outside the Soviet Union in embassies as attachés. And I know the first time I was there, the officer who was in particular, who had particular responsibility for liaison with the U.S. and Canada, had served in Ottawa So we used to sort of talk to him about how he had a Canadian daughter while he'd get all defensive. I said, no, she's a Russian. You know, no, they were really, frosty and totally unforthcoming. And on my second tour, there was a naval captain who was a senior officer in that branch, and I knew I had just come from the UK, and I had seen him on UK TV. He had been the naval attaché in London, and so he would appear on certain occasions. The BBC would show him, and he happened to be a very very likable, sophisticated individual, and I asked him once at a reception. I said, "You know, why do you treat us with such, in such a standoff way? You know, why don't you, why don't we have a better relationship with you?" I said, "You know, surely when I know that when you were in London, you were very much part of the attaché circuit, and you had access to people and scenes and so on." And he was a little bit. He said, "Well, I'll get back to you." So at a later reception, he took me aside and he said, "Well, I think about your question. In fact, the answer is that if it all depends on the political relationship between our countries. So you know, as far as he was concerned, if Canada were much more cozy with Russia, we would enjoy better personal relations." But I think it shows that their system was very careful to limit contacts, and the only times that these the only time that atmosphere changed was when things happened, such as when Prime Minister Trudeau came. Then there was suddenly a whole other tone to our relations. We went to a grand reception where I met the top people in the Soviet Defense Forces. Similarly, at the end of my first tour, President Nixon came. That was the first U.S. president to come, and there was the Soviets opened all the doors to the Americans, and it was very, you know, they were all friendly smiles, and it was wonderful. But as soon as these VIP visitors left, the Iron Curtain came back down.
I know you mentioned your question, he went away and came back and answered it later. Yeah. Did you have any trouble getting answers to the kind of questions you asked?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because when we first arrived in Moscow, you would go around to the liaison office and meet them, and then they would say, "Well, you know, welcome to Soviet Union, and we know that you're interested in finding out, in learning about us, and what we would encourage you, you know, do that here in Moscow. You know, don't try traveling around the country. Just stay here. Read our, you know, it occurs to read our press. If you have any questions, ask us." So not long after that, there was a change in the structure of the Russian forces. They introduced a new rank bracket, and I sent over a little request to the liaisons and said, "Well, look, you know, we've seen this. Can you explain what this really means? You know, we're kind of puzzled." Mm-hmm. And you know, after about 2 weeks, this frosty answer came back and said, "Well, you can read the papers." I mean, you know, just totally unwilling to be at all helpful.
Just going to Prime Minister Trudeau's visit. Mm-hmm. What role did you play in preparing for his visit?
I didn't really have any role in preparing for his visit. We knew it was going to be a big thing for the embassy, and that was it. Yeah. And in fact, he came in a the Canadian Forces supplied the aircraft. So because I was the person most familiar with Leningrad, I went up. He was going to fly out, he and his Margaret and his entourage were going to fly out of Leningrad. So we went up to make sure that the arrangements were in place for the air crew and the hotel and where they were going to stay and so on. So that was my only involvement, was arranging for the military people who'd come with him.
Okay. I know we talked this a little bit about this earlier, but sure. What kind of effect did his visit have on your work as a Canadian naval attaché?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it didn't. Yeah. It certainly affected the fact that Pierre Trudeau had a great personal interest in improving relations with the Soviet Union. And Ambassador Ford has written about that in his memoirs, how Trudeau very much, you know, sort of centralized this initiative in his office and was driving this. So that meant the whole Canadian government was trying to respond, and the embassy staff were all trying to find ways of finding entrees into with the Soviets, and so the rest of the embassy was sort of uncomfortable about having these military guys who were always sort of traveling around trying to feel the pulse of the Canadian military. So I know from that point of view, there was sort of a normal a level of strain, because the I think the Canadian Foreign Service was that time was not terribly militarily minded. They sort of, you know, found us a, it was all a bit strange for them to have these military guys, as to say, whose job was obviously to try to observe the country and find out what they could. And this sort of was accentuated prior to the Prime Minister's visit. I traveled with an American attaché down in off the Black Sea. We did a trip on a ship up the along the borders of Romania, and we got I had a camera seized by the KGB, and the ambassador was just appalled. He said, "You know, how could you possibly do this? You know, the PM is coming. The last thing we might want is, you know, for my naval attaché to be, so you know, on the front page of the papers and so on." So certainly, his visit did color the feelings of the embassy towards us. Yeah.
Were there any kind of consequences, or did they just take the camera?
I got the camera back. I was sort of going down the staircase, and this civilian sort of, you know, tried to sort of rip. Well, yeah, he actually sort of, you know, pulled it right out, pulled it. And, you know, and said, and my neck went over, and so he demanded the camera. I got the camera back. They took the film, and no, there were no direct consequences. Although that was alluded to later, months later, the same liaison officer who had been in Ottawa, he referred to it when in a conversation with our senior officer. He said, "Well, you know, now we still got that film at." Commodore Drent or something, you know. He was sort of elliptically mentioned that they had this film. Yeah.
What were they concerned about with the film?
They didn't want us taking pictures of any military installations, and I think we'd seen some anarchist little gunboats or something, and we were trying to get pictures, and we thought that we had done it in such a way that they weren't noticing, but you know. They obviously had noticed, yeah.
So you talked about kind of the effect the Prime Minister's visit had mm-hmm. with the Canadian attaches. It have an effect on the Russian side? Kind of your interactions with your liaison officers after that?
At these diplomatic receptions, when during the Prime Minister's visit, yeah, they were all smiles, friendly, not the normal sort of evasive, you know, sort of a furtive good evening, and then they'd sort of move off. But once he left, no, there was no afterglow.
And did President Nixon's visit in 1972 have any effect on your duties?
No, only that all Western attachés, all Western embassies seemed to bask in this warmth of expectations about better relations and so on. But then, you know, after the president left, that all changed. Yeah.
And can you tell me a little bit more about your posting in London after you left Moscow for the first time?
Yeah, well, I was on exchange with the Royal Navy. Mm-hmm. I was on the staff of their staff college, so I was, and there was a British naval officer was on the staff of our staff college in Toronto. Mm-hmm. So the system was I was a tutor for 12 officers from various navies, and we would work our way through standard. In a seminar type setting, we would do exercises together, and otherwise we would attend lectures. They would read books, read book reports, this sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned in 1976 you participated in a Canadian naval visit to Leningrad. Can you talk a bit about that experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the first time our Navy made an official visit to the U.S. Soviet Union. In the very early years of the Soviet Union, a ship from here went over to Kamchatka because there was a round-the-world flight by a British aviator, and they needed fuel drops and support. So Canada sent this little minesweeper, and they went to Petropavlovsk, and that was, as I say, the early days of the Soviet Union, so that's the first time the Canadian flag went over there. Well, it was a visit to Leningrad as the, as an obvious port for such a visit, and Canada sent three ships. We sent a Commodore in charge, and so I went as his aide because I had been to Moscow and spoke Russian, and it was a big effort for our Navy. We took a band from Halifax. They flew over to Denmark, I guess, and boarded one of the ships, and it was quite a full program in Leningrad, where there were some sports events for our sailors and Russian sailors, and there was band concerts and sort of official calls and reception aboard our ships for visiting for Soviet dignitaries. Mm-hmm. So that was seen as a chance to try to make contact with a large number of individuals, where normally you couldn't do that. But if you had hundreds of people come to a reception, they all went back with some memory of being aboard a Canadian ship. It was kind of sad because we had, you know, they had this buffet with oranges, and I remember, you know, these women sort of filling their bags with oranges and stuff, helping themselves to all these consumer goods, which just were not available in the Soviet Union.
So did the visit have an effect on the kind of the Soviet-Canadian relations later on?
Well, one has to hope to. One has to hope so. I was, you know, I went in and out, so I didn't. I wasn't privy to what happened. I think these visits happened, and then they, in the big scheme of things, one hopes that they do contribute to some lessening of misunderstandings. Yeah.
And what were the three ships that were sent for the visit?
Yeah, well, there was a destroyer Athabaskan, which mm-hmm. is still in the Navy, and then there was this for Ottawa, and I think it was Marguerite. Yeah, so those were two helicopter destroyers, which has since been retired. Okay. This was a long time ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did your second posting as a naval attaché in Moscow in 1977 come about?
Yeah. Well, I volunteered to go back because I was found the whole experience quite stimulating and interesting, and it happened that it was suitable for the Navy because I think somebody who was being trained and wasn't able to follow through, whether there was a health issue or the wife decided they didn't want to do it or the family decided, you know, something went wrong. So it was convenient that I went. But I went for 1 year instead of two. That was sort of the understanding. Mm-hmm. And it was much easier the second time around because we knew what to expect. We knew what the living conditions were like. We recruited a young woman in England as a nanny, so to look after our daughters when we were away and to help around the house. So, you know, domestically it was much easier.
And how did your family feel about going back?
Well, my wife initially was not enthusiastic, but she, as I said, because she felt much better prepared and I think enjoyed the experience a lot more the second time around. Mm-hmm.
And did you have to undergo any additional training before you went back?
No, I did go to Ottawa and to touch base with the intelligence staff to find out about latest developments, and I also spent a bit of time at the language school sort of brushing up on conversational Russian.
Mm-hmm. And how did your second posting to Moscow compare with your first?
Well, the work was quite similar, again because I was familiar with the job. It was in many ways easier. I mean, I think there's no question that, but there was quite a steep learning curve, and I had that behind me, so I think I was probably able to be a lot more productive much earlier in the second time around because I knew what to do and knew who to talk to and all that sort of thing. And the additional, we haven't talked about the fact that it was also accredited to Finland the first time around. All three attachés were accredited to Finland, and that was convenient for us because not only was good military relations with Finland were important for Canada and for Finland, because Finland was towing this difficult line, mm-hmm. trying to be West, you know, aligned with the West, and also not upsetting the Russians. And of course, they had their own history of having been invaded by Russia in 1939. Mm-hmm. So it was important that we demonstrate interest in the Finns, and also for us, it was a wonderful opportunity to get out to a Western country because we did feel kind of that the atmosphere in Moscow could get oppressive, and you go to Helsinki and it was just like being at home. So, but the second time, so that was the same, and then the second time around, I was also accredited to Poland, and that was something new. I was, you know, Captain Carley was here, but I was the first naval attaché to Poland, and that was quite interesting because the atmosphere in Poland was much more friendly than the atmosphere in Moscow.
Right.
So in your second posting, you're also credited to Warsaw. So
yes.
What was your experience in Poland like?
Well, I traveled several times in Poland, again with other attachés, and again to the coastal areas. And when I went to make my accreditation call with the Polish liaison officers, the atmosphere was quite different. They said, well, you know, welcome to Poland, you know, we're glad to see a representative of Canada, and we know, of course, that you're going to be trying to find out something about our military forces, and we understand that. At the same time, we just want to remind you that we have areas that are out of bounds and they're clearly marked, and we have sentries, and we want you to respect those. And otherwise, enjoy traveling. And it was very different from Moscow. They said, stay here, you know, ask us if you want to know something. So off we went. And yes, they were, when we passed military installations, we could see there were sentries at times, and they looked very, you know, very alert and very smart. You know, I understood from attachés resident in Warsaw that there were attachés who had tried to buck the system. I think there was a Belgian, you know, who deliberately drove into the woods in a Polish military area, and he was, well, think he was sort of roughed up by the security people, so it wasn't a nice story, but, you know, I mean, he was asking for it, so one felt that the polls were quite different that way. And there were also stories. I traveled with a Canadian colonel, and he told me how he, on occasion, at the end of the day, he had done his travels, and he, you know, he had a, there was a car with surveillance behind him. He went back and said, look, guys, you know, it's been a long day. I'm going home now. You can go home too. And they said, fine. And you know, he was able to have, they were able to have a sort of a working relationship with the surveillance.
Okay. So you mentioned the surveillance. Did you need the kind of permissions in Poland that you did when you were in Moscow?
No. That was the big thing. They just said, there are certain areas, stay out of them. Otherwise, just go ahead.
Okay. And then the surveillance was different as well?
Yes, I think it was much more discreet.
So how?
And I'm not sure whether we were even, you know, we weren't really conscious of being tailed. I think because what could we do? I mean, you know, we're a couple of, you know, non-Polish speakers going to be contacting people. And at that time, too, you know, they were closing in on the years of Solidarność, and they had all kinds of internal issues. I don't think they were that worried about a couple of NATO attaches sort of driving along the coast. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any interaction with the civilians in Poland?
Well, a bit, and in hotels and restaurants, and they were much more open at that time. I came to learn that there were a lot of Poles even then. This was in the 70s, late 70s, who were working abroad in Germany and England in particular, and they were remitting money back to Poland, so that was quite important economically. So Poland was much... Polish citizens had a lot more contact with the outside world and were very aware of what was going on in the outside world. Whereas in Russia at the time, there was very limited contact with the outside world. Russians, by and large, could not travel outside. There wasn't the internet, which there is now. Mm-hmm. They listened to the BBC, but all the big Soviet cities had these big radio towers, which were used to jam foreign broadcasts. So there was a huge effort in Russia to keep information about the outside out.
Okay.
It's interesting. We're all going back to that now. Yeah.
Is there any other kind of differences between your time in Moscow and your time in Poland that you want to bring up?
No, I don't think so. These countries generally did arrange liaison visits. I did one to up to the coast, and we went aboard a Polish training ship, and we had an address by the admiral in charge of the Polish Navy, and he was remarkably frank about their relationship with the Soviets and how, you know, how Poland had to had a fairly limited freedom to pursue independent policies and so on. You know, he was quite, as I say, quite forthcoming. We were all surprised. Yeah.
Were you ever able to go on board a Russian ship while you were stationed there, or stationed in Moscow?
Yeah. No, I didn't. There was, during my time, there was a visit to a Russian submarine. I missed that. I think it was back in Canada. Halfway through, we came back home. Otherwise, we did visits to army barracks, and there was a standard army barracks outside Moscow where attachés were taken every couple of years to a sort of a show division. Well, sure, I shouldn't say that. We also visited the Russian Naval Academy in St. Petersburg, but it was disappointing there too. They made a huge effort to make sure we had no contact with the students, you know, and weren't able to talk to anybody. We were just sort of shepherded around and shown things and put on the bus. Yeah.
Can you tell me about the Navy conference you participated in Finland in 1978?
Yes, and maybe I should add parenthetically. Mm-hmm. Many years later, there was a Russian sail training ship came here, the Palata, from Vladivostok, and I did liaison with them for the tall ships. And gee, it was such a different atmosphere. As I've said, the Russians are very warm, very cordial, and it was a wonderful experience to be. In fact, I ended up sailing with them to San Francisco. It was I have a lot of very warm memories of interactions with individual Russian sailors, whereas in my time in Moscow, that was not the case. The Finnish, yes, the Scandinavian countries, I think, are quite interested, of course, in pursuing independent policies and in trying to defuse tensions. So the Swedish Navy, I think, had organized a conference of senior officers from navies from both blocks, Western and Eastern, and then Finland did this in 1978. So this was a conference of naval leaders from all Scandinavian and Atlantic nations, and I went as the aide to our admiral, who was then in. At the time, we sent the admiral who was in Halifax, mm-hmm. and it was a very interesting several days, very skillfully put together by the Finns, and there was lots of interchange there between these senior officers from various nations, who found they had a fair amount in common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did the Russians participate in that conference as well?
No, they did. It was Admiral Chernobyl. He was sort of the number two man, and he was he was very affable, and he took it in on himself to have a little private talk with each one of the leading NATO admirals. So he had a walk with the Canadian admiral too. He didn't take. You know, he had his own interpreter, so I'm not sure what they talked about, but the admiral told me that, Chernobyl was obviously out to charm or to to reduce tensions. And my wife and I, in fact, flew back to Moscow on the same airplane. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if that was a Russian airplane or a Finnish airplane. In any event, there we were sitting in the aircraft now, and he came on board with his team, and he went out of his way to say, "Oh, hello, nice to see you again." And so, he was being very, very, very cordial, yeah. And I don't know if I mentioned my written stuff that when I, that same Canadian admiral, Admiral Collier, who's now dead. The senior Russian admiral at the time was quite well known, Admiral Gorshkov. Admiral Gorshkov was flying to Cuba, and his plane stopped in Halifax for fuel. And our admiral in Halifax, Admiral Collier, the airport in Halifax is, it's about 20 miles out. He went out and called on the admiral, on the Russian admiral. He went out to welcome him, and had a brief polite conversation, but I think that made a big impression on the Russians, because in my first time in Moscow, I never formally met any senior officers. I met them at receptions, mm-hmm. but we were supposed to be presented to the senior people in the Soviet Navy, so that as a representative of Canada. Well, that never happened. Second time around, I got this phone call saying, we've organized a visit with you for you with the chief of the Russian naval staff, and how about next Monday at 2 or whatever, I forget, it was a fairly short notice. So off I went, and then again, this was an admiral called Yegorov. He was very cordial, we had about 45 minute conversation, and I brought the conversation around to aircraft carriers, because at the time the Russians were building aircraft carriers, and we were supposed to find out what we could about this. And he sort of smiled and sort of batted this question off, but in a very collegial sort of way. So, but he early on raised the fact that how much they appreciated what how Admiral Collier had welcomed Admiral Gorshkov. Mm-hmm. And my American colleague also then, at the same time, got his call. So I think that mm-hmm. the fact the Canadian Admiral had been courteous to a Russian, mm-hmm. that got us both in into these, to have these encounters. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So did the Naval Conference have an effect on your work as Moscow?
Well, not a lasting effect, because we went back to being in the embassy and didn't get any invitations from the Russians. No, but it provided interesting insights into their thinking. And as I say, they had these various seminars, and I was at one about Coast Guard and rescue at sea and that sort of thing. And there were all these senior officers sitting around a room telling each other how their navies had become involved. And it was interesting. That's at that time, that Germany was separated, was divided, and that's the first time the senior German West German officer had met his East German counterpart, and that was that was significant. They had several face to face talks, which I'm sure was a very good thing, and that was so. Good for the Finns for providing this sort of forum, so people could get together, and they would then have a better understanding of who the other side was, and if a search in that particular case of a search and rescue incident came up, they would have some understanding and saying, oh yeah, the Poles, I know they've got this is what they've got, and this is how they operate, and so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were there any ceremonies or events you participated in as a naval attaché that are especially memorable for you?
Well, we just mentioned that one, and when the Prime Minister came, we laid a wreath at the they have a sort of a flame for the unknown soldier in Moscow, and that was significant. And we also did a ceremony at the wreath laying, and also during the naval visit, we did a wreath laying at there's a gigantic cemetery in Leningrad where I think it's 800,000 people are buried. It's just astonishing, and these there were just mounds of bodies. But that's a very moving place, and so it was moving to go there, both with the Prime Minister and with our naval contingent.
Did your time as a naval attaché in Moscow affect the rest of your career?
Well, personally, it did, because it was a very enriching experience. Mm-hmm. I think from a career point of view, it was probably not really a good move, because I was sort of out of the Navy for 3 years the first time, and when you're in your 30s, your colleagues are doing other things and getting noticed and so on. So it's probably not a. But I knew that, because I know that there was an Army officer, and I remember I mentioned that I was at the staff college when I was asked, and there was a colonel there who had been in Egypt, and he said, "Look, you don't want to do this. You go off to be an attaché, and it's just not good for your career." But then you sort of weigh things up. Wow, a chance to live in Russia for 2 years. Isn't that pretty significant? I think it was. Yeah.
Was that common that people thought that becoming a naval attaché would affect their career kind of in a bad way?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was recognized that it was not really a career-enhancing move. On the other hand, you've met Admiral George. He was in Japan and didn't really hurt him that much. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And have you ever been back to the Soviet Union?
Yes. We went back 4 years ago to St. Petersburg and Moscow, and we're astonished at how Russia has changed. Huge improvement in standard of living, and huge improvement in the way everything looks, because under the under the communist rule, there was little incentive to sort of, you know, cut the grass or you know, sort of make things look attractive. Now it's startling, and they and at the same time, there's a lot of concerns, I think, in Russia about preserving their culture, but you know, they still have a very high standard of education, and young people are taught to appreciate the Russian culture, and at the same time, we can see all the armed guards outside banks and things, so you realize that security is not what it used to be in the good old USSR. Yeah.
And what, in your opinion, is the importance of having a naval attaché in Moscow?
Well, first of all, it's a demonstration by Canada of interest in in a very significant navy, and that's, you know, that's a sign by us that we're interested in them. It also gives our navy a chance to have an observer there who can absorb impressions and report back. Mm-hmm. I guess you could make a whole argument saying, well, back in 1910, when it was such a different world, it was really important to have people on the ground who could report it. Nowadays we have, you know, radio intercepts, satellites whizzing around and so on. We have a lot more information available than we did then. So is it important to have somebody there? Well, yeah, I think so.
And is there anything else that you'd like to discuss?
No. That's it? You can think of, yeah.
Okay. That's it. So this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Commodore Ian Drent on March 21st, 2014. Commodore Drent, I'd like to thank you for participating in the interview today. I'll just ask you to fill out the top part of our form here, up here,
sure.
Please.
You're Sarah with a H.
Yes.
Okay, Thompson.
Oh, I can do that part. That's okay. Me, Taylor. Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. So we have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Perfect. Signed it. Thank you very much.